Hello and welcome to Between the Bubbles, your place for independent and critical takes on topics at the nexus of science, society, politics, and economics. I'm your host, Ninad Bondre. Thanks for joining me.
And also the rise of these tech giants with immense power
that has so far remained
quite unregulated. Now things are starting to change, but it is still kind of worrying that there hasn't been more debate about how to regulate social media. There's more been debate about how to remove bad content.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and I brought it up in a previous episode too, but recently there was a letter by some former and maybe current intelligence community people in the US, and they were essentially making the argument that the US Senate and House, which have some bills in process to possibly regulate big tech, that they shouldn't do that because, you know, otherwise we won't be able to control information, and that, you know, we will be far more susceptible to disinformation campaigns and so on. So there are, you know, centers of power that are, on the one hand, they are, you know, against this sort of regulation because they look at big tech as sort of tools to use in for national purposes, nationalistic purposes. And on the other hand, you also have, you know, places like in the EU where they also want big tech to be regulated, but they seem to have their own agendas there too. So again, I guess this is quite a complex issue of, you know, how to regulate them and which form of regulation is a transparent form of regulation, which is not associated with any agendas as such.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the core discussions that should be had in democratic societies these years. And I think it has not been lifted, this debate. Like, journalists also have I guess thought it was like too complex or too people are not interested in that. But I think that most social media users also have opinions about how social media could become better and work better for democracy. I don't buy the argument that people don't care. And I think, again, so this debate has really only been held by kind of political elites in the EU, for example. I think we can talk about the Digital Services Act, which I think contains some really good aspects, but also some worrying aspects. Yeah. But again, I just wish that this kind of debate was not just being held at the top EU level, but was being held out in European democracies, and the same in the US. It has really not been a very broad or public debate, despite people having a very intimate relationship with social media. I mean, of course, not everyone is on social media, but those who are, again, I think they know these platforms. They know what works and what does not work. And including people in that kind of debate, I think, is really important. And that has not been done. Again, I think some of the post-truth scare has kind of obscured that debate in some way. But I think if we talk about the Digital Services Act, which is this new act in the European Union that's going to regulate social media companies. I think what is really good about it is that it tries to increase transparency, right? It tries to make it so that content moderation becomes more transparent, which is something actually I and others have argued for quite some time. I gave a testimony to the Council of Europe back in 2019 and talking about, like, content moderation, for example, being really important to make more transparent. Like, at the moment, as most social media users know, if something gets removed, like, you don't know if that was an algorithm that decided that, or if it was a person. If it was a person, speaks your language, what was the, like, motivation for it? And also, there's no real way of kind of appealing that. Or if you appeal, you can hit a button saying, I disagree, but then you don't know, is it now going to be a person? Is that person going to speak my language? Like all these things. And we've heard these horrible stories, right, of Facebook not having any content moderators speaking certain languages, like during the genocide in Myanmar. It was like one person who spoke the language that worked for Facebook as a content moderator.
Right.
So, so for example, now in the Digital Services Act, social media companies will have to give reports and say how many people they have employed to content moderate in different languages, which I think is really good. And they need to be more transparent about what they take down, on what grounds people will have ways of appealing, which I think is really important. So like there is an increasing transparency, which is good. But like the worrying part for me is the part meant to address disinformation specifically, which is this part about during a crisis, the EU can decide that social media companies need to take down certain content. And that can be for a 3-month period at a time. But of course, the notion of crisis, I think, like, from as a media scholar, as a like social scientist, when any politicians talk about this will only be applied during a crisis, I think most social scientists are quite worried because when is something a crisis, right?
Yeah,
we know how political leaders have a tendency to make things into a crisis, right?
Yes.
Suddenly things become allowed because we are in a state of emergency, right? And I think that is worrying, that suddenly political actors will be able to influence or decide what kind of media content can be out there on the internet. And I think that is a worrying development. And again, we might say, yeah, but we trust our European politicians. But we need to remember, when we go back to like the core of democracy, that our regulations, our laws should not be based on having kind and benevolent politicians.
Yep.
Like it just takes the election of one horrible popular political leader to start calling everything a crisis and banning all kinds of critical journalism, critical voices. So I think this is a very dangerous development. And I also know, like, it was apparently something that was added just last minute to the Digital Services Act. So I'm very skeptical towards that part, but I think there are good aspects. Making content moderation more transparent is very good. Limiting targeted ads so that children can't be targeted to the same extent, and that people have more options to opt out of targeting. And with targeting, of course, I mean like social media companies directing ads to you based on your preferences and what you have liked and so forth. So yeah, there are positives, but there are certainly also negatives. And I just wish that this whole debate around how to regulate social media was not just held by these elite actors, and that includes, I mean, me as an academic also. I don't want to be the person who tells the politicians what to do. I think in a democracy, we need experts, we need academics, we need also journalists to inform people about what is going on. But the fundamental principle needs to be that it is also people who decide what needs to happen, right? And I think again, this is not really happening with social media. And I think again, the fact that EU is so opaque and centralized is definitely something that is contributing to some of the problems for European democracies, right?
I mean, you've hit the nail on the head, really. And in some ways, I think what we've come up with, or what we can distill out of this, is also that the role that elites have played. I mean, it's been a bit unfortunate that elites started asserting this sort of a role exactly at a time when large parts of the world's population were sort of reacting against elites and experts, you know, whether it be legitimate or not, you know, those grievances, they were expressed. I mean, during the Brexit times, for example, people made the argument that decision making is, you know, increasingly removed from them and takes place in opaquely in Europe. In America, obviously, the Trumpist movement had to do with, you know, a critique of elites and mainstream establishment and so on. And just while this was happening, then, as you say, you know, the solutions proposed to the so-called post-truth problem were, you know, reclaiming elite and expert authority in some ways. So I think that's really unfortunate.
I definitely agree with that. And I think, again, like this is something, for example, Chantal Mouffe, the political theorist, has written about, like, why do we see the rise of far-right populism, for example, in so many countries? And her answer is that it is this kind of democratic deficit in so many countries that really fuels these far-right nationalist movements. Because Trump does, for example, or what Le Pen does, or like all these far-right leaders, they speak into this feeling of being left out, right? Not being involved in democracy, right? And the problem is that there is no candidate on the other side also talking into that or wanting to change that, right? So with the Brexit election, but also with the election of Trump, I mean, what we need to remember is that these were both binary elections, right? There are only two options, basically, right? And so you can either go with the status quo, which is Remain and Hillary Clinton, or you can choose something that is kind of a middle finger to the status quo, right?
Exactly.
Which is Brexit and which is Trump, and that ends up being those end up being the winning results, right? And I think again that again goes back to like structural issues around like horse race elections between only two candidates, which is like the US parliamentary system encourages, right? Or like incentivizes. Yep. So I think again, there we see the democracies where it's easier for smaller parties to get into parliament and so forth. They fare better in this regard because they also allow people with different contrarian viewpoints. I mean, far left voters who are very angry at the political system from one side can vote for the socialist or communist party, and the far right disenfranchised voter or angry voters can vote for the far right party, and then these parties will have to try to find some kind of compromise, that is again democracy is about like trying to find compromise between very different positions and not necessarily like liking each other, right? But agreeing that we allow each other to exist, right? Yeah. And this is kind of what is breaking down in the US, where we really see democracy like potentially falling apart, I would say. Because the there is no outlet for this anger with the political status quo, and so it ends up being funneled into this far-right nationalist movement that is not advocating for a stronger democracy, right? We're also seeing it in Hungary, and I mean we're seeing it in a lot of different countries. But again, fixing disinformation on social media is not going to fix that. Like that is not going to be fixed by that. It needs to be the other way around. I mean, we need to fix democracy to also fix information or make information better, and not the other way around. And again, we see the argument being presented as if we just fix information, we fix all these problems that have been going on for decades.
I agree completely. And, you know, I made this point in a previous conversation too, that it reminds me of the climate skepticism discussion also. And I wrote something about it over a decade ago now, when the IPCC report had come out and you had this big controversy breaking out, and then skepticism really j- jumped into the mainstream. And then again, there was a tendency to, you know, solve this by fact. So we just need to provide more information, better information, win this war with information. And I, at the time, I had also made the point that, you know, this is not going to be solved by information alone. This points to something else deeper, and that you need to target that. At the time, I had sort of linked it to political polarization in places like the US and UK. Over the years, others have, you know, brought in other sorts of things to do with how people process information and various biases and tribal affinities. So they, you might analyze in many different ways, but I think most who have worked on it agree that information, this isn't really primarily about information. But it seems that despite some really compelling work being done on it, it is very, very almost irresistible for the mainstream community, even of academics, to just call for more information. And I'm just thinking also of the March for Science movement that happened around the same time, you know, 2016, 2017. And people also marched with these slogans, which were in some ways very, very simplistic and naive, but could also be looked at as reasserting the authority of expertise and science. So it just seems it's very hard to get in a critical voice in this climate.
Yeah, I would say on a positive note that I expected that more colleagues would be more critical towards the arguments we were making. But I actually feel that a lot of people had been thinking along similar lines, critical lines, not necessarily expressing them loudly, but that there is also, a skepticism within scholarly communities across around filter bubbles, echo chambers, fake news, post-truth, so forth, right? But at the same time, I do agree that that again and again, the solutions become like more information, better information, information literacy, and so forth. And I think one of the reasons actually is that these kinds of solutions around information literacy and more and better information, they are less political, right? They're less politically charged. And scholars often don't want to be seen as activists, right? So they come up with solutions that are seem more politically neutral, right? But if you want to fix a political problem, you also need to come up with political solutions. I mean, that's just logics for me. So again, and this is also why it shouldn't just be scholars providing the solution, because the solution is not just some kind of expert thing that we could come up with. It is about, again, deepening democratic institutions. And I think for that, scientists and scholars are not actually always the best to propose solutions, because again, they are often fearful of taking a political stance and being seen as a very political. But in terms of what you just talked about before with climate change denial also, I think that actually also shows us again the importance of discussing political economy and finance, because and power, because when we talk about disinformation, for example, so often it is being discussed as being this kind of bottom-up thing or problem with the masses on social media. People don't listen anymore. They are trapped in filter bubbles. They have their own realities. But when you look at who is actually spreading the worst disinformation about COVID-19, for example, you need to look towards press conferences with political leaders, right? Exactly. And the same with climate change. And some research have studied that, like, the reason there is so much climate change denial is because the fossil fuel industry has spent hundreds of millions over the past decades to spread these narratives, hire these speakers, promote certain, I mean, scholars who engage in like whataboutism around climate change. They've made sure to fund those, right? So again, the solution to all of these things is also comes back to political solutions around regulating the fossil fuel industry, right? So they don't have so much spare cash to spend on on PR or again with politicians, it comes down to again certain politicians, populist far right politicians, benefiting from this mistrust that exists in the population to then kind of score points in among their voters by talking about like the deep state and the elites and COVID-19, like not trusting experts and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. All of this mm-hmm. is made possible by the underlying structural problems of people not, again, feeling they have influence in democracy and have any kind of say in what is going on.
Actually, we could even devote a couple more episodes to this topic, particularly. And I would be very happy to have you over again. I think this has gone really well so far. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Yeah, such a pleasure.
Absolutely. But I can maybe then close up or try to close up with a question where you mentioned COVID a couple of times. And then obviously, in your book, you have mentioned, for example, the work of Stefan Lewandowski and colleagues. And then they express this concern that if we don't fight post-truth, then we might enter a world in which, you know, even medical issues will become a matter of opinion rather than, you know, expert judgment. And I don't quite agree with this, but I was wondering, you know, now that we had the COVID pandemic a couple of years after he wrote this, whether there is any material to empirically test that fear, let's say. I don't know if you managed to look at this or think about this a little bit, and also to explore how these notions you've focused on in the book of truth and democracy, how they've played out during the pandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. So much has happened, right? Because our book came out in late 2019, and the rest is history. I mean, then came COVID and now the war in Ukraine. And so, I mean, it was already difficult to keep up with the debate while we wrote the book, but it has certainly only moved faster since. So I think what Lewandowski and colleagues talked about was again the social media giving rise to this kind of negotiation of what is true, right? That people in the future might no longer even believe in medical knowledge, right? That was the argument. And I think, I mean, on the one hand, I think they predicted something, right? In the sense that COVID came and suddenly there was all this this skepticism and disinformation around the pandemic. But I think what they didn't get right is that they talk about this as deriving from social media primarily, right? And I think, again, if we look at where disinformation and mistrust in authorities, medical authorities came from during COVID, it was very much, again, press conferences with Trump, Bolsonaro, Chinese officials. I mean, so in that sense, it is true that medical knowledge certainly also became subject to the same skepticism we had already seen towards journalism and politicians. I would say that what did not turn out to be the case was that it primarily derived from like users on social media. I think again, and that points to deeper historical path or deeper historical root of these things. That again, political leaders using a moment of crisis to sow doubt and to challenge medical authorities and try to especially like the white male politicians, populist leaders positioning themselves as like saviors during a crisis who knows best. That is like an archetype that goes back a long time, right? I mean, that is also what I have seen with like fascist leaders in the 20th century and so forth. Mm. So, I mean, so it's not exactly like the novelty, I would say, is not as great as some predicted in terms of social media. But at the same time, I mean, it is certainly true what they predicted, that medical knowledge would also be subject to more and more debate and opinion. In terms of our own book, one thing we talked about and problematized was how many politicians and scholars and journalists talked about fake news as a virus before COVID, right? That fake news is a virus, is a plague, and we need to eradicate this plague. And what we saw as the danger was that by framing this as a plague, we also frame solutions as being similar to a plague, right? We need to eradicate it. We need to vaccinate people. And these kind of things might work for a virus, or they do, but they don't work the same with information, right? You can't just remove information and then fix it, because what you are removing is obviously something written by people somewhere, right?
Yes.
And you end up potentially like limiting people's freedom of speech, right? And targeting politicians can use that to target groups they don't like, journalists they don't like, and so forth, right? So the analogy is dangerous, we said. And what has then happened is that that metaphor just exploded even more, right? Because it got entangled with the notion of the infodemic. So just when COVID hit, Tedros Ghebreyesus from the World Health Organization went out and said, we're not just dealing with an epidemic. This was before it was called a pandemic. We are also dealing with an infodemic, which is spreading faster than the disease, right? And here, what is problematic with this term and is, again, that it frames information as similar to a virus so that we can just remove it and fix it. But also, it conflates even what is accurate and inaccurate information, right? Is an infodemic bad? I mean, what the term captures is that there is more information now floating out there than ever before. And a lot of information floating around all countries about this new dangerous situation, right? Which makes sense. Like it is a first pandemic in 100 years. So it would make perfect sense for there to be a lot of information, right? And it also would make perfect sense for there to be a lot of bad information, right? Because that is not new either. If we look at like the Ebola outbreaks in the past in Africa, or if we look at, even the Spanish flu 100 years ago, there was a lot of misinformation around these kind of outbreaks, that people thinking that they have found a cure when it's not, people having like all kinds of basic advice around what you need to eat and don't eat to protect yourself. So, I mean, that is not new, that a crisis situation with a lot of uncertainties spark false information or bad information. That is not new. Of course, it can spread faster and in new ways due to social media. But again, the problem with the infodemic concept is that it then legitimized all these emergency measures. Just as we had emergency measures to tackle COVID, it was then legitimate to implement emergency measures that would make it illegal to spread like misinformation, which can be defined whichever way you want, right, around government handling of COVID, for example. And this is again the problem that is often neglected by researchers when they talk about these things and by journalists, is that scholars pretend as if fake news is not one of the most contested terms of our time, right? They say we need to tackle fake news, and we need to do so through regulation. Okay. But the problem is that fake news is not just vague, we have called it a floating signifier, right? It is a concept that has opposing meanings depending on who you ask. If you ask Donald Trump what fake news is, he can give you a clear answer. It's just the complete opposite answer of other political actors, right? This is the problem. By saying, we have an infodemic, we need to tackle it with harsh measures, you legitimize politicians to then ban fake news and then fill in their own definition of fake news when it's implemented, right? And this is sadly what we've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree with you. And going back to Lewandowski, in a way, you know, some of what they said was borne out here. I guess I would just like to make one point about that, which is that, I mean, this also has to do with the fundamental uncertainty, you know, of the times. And even scientific information produced in the best labs and by the best experts didn't always agree with, you know, information produced elsewhere by the best labs and best experts. So there was this fundamental sort of uncertainty that accompanies scientific endeavors, especially during these times. And it seemed almost as if there wasn't a sufficient sort of humility to accept and acknowledge that, you know, this scientific information, even of high quality, is sort of going to be one contribution to the overall decision-making process. And it has to do with life and death issues, you know, people, how they're going to take care of their children, their employment situation, and so many other aspects in life which go into decision-making. And again, at least from liberal quarters, it seemed to me that there wasn't sufficient recognition of some of these other elements, and any concerns people raised were, again, just like post-truth, you know, ascribed to the other section or other side of the divide, who were then again portrayed as lacking knowledge or lacking the nuance or just being unaware generally.
Yeah, definitely. I think. Again, the fake news debate where it becomes very much black and white, it has portrayed science as always having like black and white answers, right?
Yeah.
And not like as this very slow and gradual process where people come to conflicting results, and over time something emerges as a kind of a consensus around how things work. And I think that by portraying it as super black and white, it became it led to more misunderstanding sometimes during COVID. I was often called by journalists asking, is this fake news or real news, right? and so often I had to say to them, like, this is too early. You can't say it's a single study or these kind of things. There was one very peculiar case for me where, because I live in Copenhagen in Denmark and commute to Sweden and work, so I was kind of in between two countries that had different regulations.
Right.
And giving interviews with journalists. And then there was this case where Swedish authorities had said masks don't work.
Exactly.
With reference to a Danish study that had just come out. And this Danish study had some limitations because it only gave people masks and then saw if more people got infected when they had a mask. And they couldn't find noticeable differences. But the problem was, this was a situation where they were the only ones wearing masks. Like, there wasn't a mask mandate in Denmark at the time. So it was only one way, right? It was only the test, the subjects, research subjects that were wearing masks and not everyone else. That was one thing.
Yeah.
And then there was just very little spread of COVID during the study because it was during the summer in Denmark where there wasn't a lot of spread. So, yeah. I mean, the results came out and I think they, like, it was not a flawed study in that sense, but it had some limitations. The authors acknowledged that. And some were then using that on social media to say masks don't work at all, like the anti-mask movement was using this study. And Facebook was then starting to limit the spread of these kind of claims, that this proves. At the same time in Sweden, authorities were saying kind of the same thing, that this study proves that masks don't work or shows that masks don't work. So journalists were calling me and saying, are we spreading fake news? Why is Facebook not limiting our article that says the same thing that some of these US anti-mask groups are spreading? And I mean, what is the answer to that? I mean, it all derives from both journalists and politicians and social media companies wanting to have these very clear black and white answers at a time where we just don't have them. I mean, we just didn't have that clear evidence yet of exactly how much do masks reduce COVID-19 since more extensive studies have come out. And we now know that masks have an effect and that has been documented, but at that time there were so few studies, so a single study coming out indicating no difference. I mean, that then became, suddenly it was real news to say that masks don't work, and later that changes, right? And that is not unusual, right? Or it's not unwanted. That's just how science works. And we were in a crisis in the sense of something sudden happening where there is a lot of uncertainty risk for people's health and lives. So people are worried. They are obviously going to try to find out what is going on. And that will also lead to them finding things that might later turn out not to be true. And journalists and politicians will also likely say something that later turns out not to be the case. But so yeah, I think, again, approaching this kind of situation, what political leaders, journalists, and also scientists need to do is, of course, be humble and acknowledge that fact. And we see that the political leaders that did the worst during COVID, I mean, studies will of course come out, I think, to even go into more details. But what seems clear just from kind of the face of it is that the leaders who did the worst during COVID were the ones who tried to claim most certainty, right?
Who
tried to say, I know it all, we just need to take this drug, or we just need to, it will be over by the summer, or these kind of things that Trump said, for example. But we also, it was not just Trump, right? It was Bolsonaro, it was a lot of different political actors that tried to present themselves as like knowing what is best in a situation where just no one knows what is best yet. And I think, again, sometimes the post-truth, fake news debate has presented science as something that it just isn't and can't live up to and shouldn't live up to. And that then hurt science a little bit during COVID, because it also becomes then a case of people saying, but if science doesn't know, I was just told last year that we need to go back to truth, and that truth is not a matter of debate. And now it's black and white, and we need to take the side of truth. And now you're telling me that science doesn't know? Like, I think it makes sense for people to be a bit unsure about how science works after all of this, right? And that also fueled some of the skepticism towards vaccines and so forth, right?
No, again, as I said, this is such a rich topic for conversation that we could just go on for hours and probably feel multiple.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, and again, it has been growing and mutating, to use this medical vocabulary.
Yes,
like the topic has when I started looking into it in 2016, really, these discourses around fake news and post-truth, I thought it was like one study I would do on the side of my work into social media disinformation. And then it has just like grown into something, also into like a monster in some ways that I never really expected. So there's definitely still a lot of work to be done on these discourses and their effects in different parts of the world. Yeah, and some researchers are taking up this, I mean, taking these critical perspectives, also studying in different geopolitical contexts, how it is playing out, because this is obviously very different in Malaysia and Singapore, where they have these strict anti-fake news laws as compared to the US or a European country. So, I mean, but what is common is that fake news and post-truth discourses around that have influenced politics in quite profound ways, I would say, pretty much across the world, which is really, really both interesting but also worrying, right? At least to the ways in which it has legitimized these anti-democratic developments.
Yep. Now that's a really good point, and hopefully it was good to hear that there is some critical work happening, and hopefully we'll see some of it come out in the coming years, and it would be very interesting to follow that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean for example, from outside the US and EU, we have also mainly talked about these regions, right? For example, I can recommend Gabrielle Lim, who is at Harvard. She did a report for Data and Society on the Malaysian Anti-Fake News Act, which was implemented and then repealed after changing government. And she studied that. Since her study came out, it has then been reinstated. Like, now there is an anti-fake news law again. And I mean, that shows, I think, that, and this is then maybe the positive note to end on, is that these things are very much still up for debate. And we can, both as scholars, citizens, journalists, and politicians can still influence this, right? It's not settled in stone how we are going to try to improve democracy, save democracy, and it's not settled how we're going to handle disinformation on social media and beyond. And I think there is then, therefore, like on a positive note, there is still time to influence these debates, still time to protest. As Gabrielle Lim documented in Malaysia, it was very much due to activists, human rights groups protesting this anti-fake news law that it then later was repealed. I mean, again, sadly, during COVID, that COVID crisis legitimized then for the government to reinstate the anti-fake news law. Yeah. So, I mean, it is not going, I would say, in a very positive direction. But what is positive is that I think there is still time to speak up and to try to influence these things.
Yeah, I think that is a positive and uplifting note to end on. I agree with you that there is room to play with and there is some scope to keep working on this. So I think that's a good note to end this conversation for today. But I'm really glad you could join me here.
Yeah, it was such a pleasure. I mean, I would love to have another talk some time. I'm sure something new has has happened in the world that we can then include.
And with that, we end part two of this wide-ranging discussion with Johan Farkas, in which we discuss democracy, media, and a whole host of issues. I hope you enjoyed the first season of this podcast that dealt with post-truth. Do alert your friends and colleagues and ask them to share the podcast further. As always, do visit the website for links to sources that were discussed in this episode. Thanks again, bye for now, and do stay posted for forthcoming episodes of this podcast.